Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Working. Behind the scenes, coming up on today's show, we'll talk to Roy Kleeper, who is the CEO and co-founder of City Hive. He'll talk a little bit about how small mom and pop and some smaller chains as well, liquor store businesses, are leveraging e-commerce to their benefit and kind of taking it under their own wings rather than outsourcing such things to the likes of Drizly. He'll also talk about some hidden costs for these type of retailers as it pertains to using those third-party services. We'll look ahead to how shipping costs may affect retailers in the back half of 2021. And in news, we've got an earnings call from a favorite on the podcast, Hibbett Sports. Even though the dollar stores, both Dollar Tree and Dollar General, released earnings this week, Hibbett, I think, caught the most eyes, even if it didn't catch the most headlines with their earnings this past week. A quick reminder that you can like us and rate us however you access us. Your ratings certainly do help others to find the podcast and check us out. So if you're enjoying what you're hearing on a weekly basis, then certainly do give us a rating. Also, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. We'll all try to do a better job of getting Leighton my pictures from retail travels throughout the country. He's been badgering me, pestering me a little bit. I should note, we regret not having a podcast certainly last week. A longtime colleague of mine, Mr. Leo Hudson, passed away, and so I took a week off to attend his memorial service, certainly, but an interesting trip to rural northern Louisiana. Saw a few retailers there as well while on that trip to the memorial service that Leighton hopefully at some point will post after I send him the pictures, of course. Now, back to retail, Hibbett Sports, as I mentioned, they lead our show. They displayed continued strength in the sporting goods sector with a massive earnings beat, but it's not all about sporting goods with Hibbett Sports, and we'll talk about that here in a second. Now, we had actually heard from a few different Hibbett store managers in April that year-to-date for them, sales were very solid, especially in the Midwestern region, setting certain store records even in some spots. Their earnings call on Friday certainly bore this out. Now, as I mentioned, Hibbett's relative success doesn't just represent momentum in sporting goods retail, although it certainly suggests that. Also showcases strength in small to mid-sized markets where they're mostly located, and also apparel and footwear sales. Hibbett increasingly, especially in their larger markets, moving that merchandise mix towards apparel and footwear. And in fact, you look now, a lot of the balance is shifting to greater than 50-50 between apparel and footwear and sporting goods in certain markets. Their website is almost exclusively geared towards apparel, especially new product launches. And the pictures used in their presentations and investor relations websites, they really seek to position the company more like a Foot Locker than, say, maybe a smaller scale Dick's Sporting Goods there. So that's why I say Hibbett's sales success doesn't just indicate strength in sporting goods right now. It indicates an increasing appetite, I think, at least, in these markets, in these small to mid-sized markets, for that athleisure wear. And when you look at these markets and you think about it, a lot of them have a lack of outlets for such products. You know, something that was mentioned on this earnings call by Hibbett is the fact that JCPenney is closing in a lot of small to mid-sized markets. Stage Stores, obviously, wiped out many of them by the recent bankruptcy. And so if you go into a town like this, really your only outlet that you can purchase athleisure wear is Walmart. And you're not getting Nike at Walmart. You're not getting Adidas at Walmart. And so unless there is an independent retailer there in that particular town, Hibbett is your only place to go. Towns as large as 50,000 people, like I said, really don't have another outlet to go to. And so Hibbett has been able to take over a lot of that. And we saw that with their brick and mortar traffic numbers and also their same store sales numbers, not just including e-commerce, but including retail stores in particular. And not to go on a pre-news tangent here, as I realize we haven't even started talking about the earnings call, but one store manager actually reminded me this spring when I was visiting her Hibbett store that a number of Hibbett's customers are still unbanked. So that means that e-commerce is left completely out of the equation for them. And this is something that I think a lot of people, when they talk about e-commerce taking over apparel and e-commerce taking over athletic gear, they kind of forget unbanked customers. So if an unbanked customer wants a Nike shirt and they live in a town of 4,000 people, like I mentioned, Hibbett's their only option. Nike doesn't have a deal with Walmart, and they don't have the option to buy online because of that unbanked status. And we should remember here, too, that we're not only talking Hibbett here, but also City Gear, which, of course, they acquired a few years back, and they comprise about 15% of their real estate footprint. So enough digressions. Let's get to the earnings call and some numbers here. Zacks consensus estimates pegged Hibbett earnings at $2.37 per share coming into the call. That was the analyst expectation. Hibbett saw this, laid those to waste. An earnings per share of an even $5, a beat of nearly 111%. By the way, that's not an adjusted earnings per share number. No adjustments to EPS for Hibbett this quarter. So that was their true earnings per share. And their comps were always going to be up over a prior year quarter that, of course, included the beginning of the pandemic. Their quarter, this is their fiscal 2022 first quarter, by the way, runs through May 1st. So usually February 1st to May 1st. You look last year, comp sales were down 19.5% for the 13 weeks ending May 2nd, 2020. That's because stores were closed about 40% of that quarter in aggregate for Hibbett. So you look and right about a month and a half of pandemic sales, or lack thereof in their case. Now, Hibbett was slightly more fortunate looking back, as their footprint is generally in the more southern U.S. where things were slower to close and quicker to open. So they might have been open maybe a few more days than their more northerly competitors. But in any case, their comps this first quarter once again of fiscal 2022, absolutely exploded. They regained what was lost in 2020 and then some. Comps increased 87.3% over Q1 of fiscal 2021. And when you ask why we're not talking about dollar stores here when they both had their earnings call this past week, this is why. That is a mind-blowing number. Not only that, but again, Hibbett has over 1,000 retail stores, right around 1,071 at the end of this quarter. Those brick-and-mortar stores saw a year-over-year increase of 113.5% in sales. That is a massive brick-and-mortar comp increase from a retailer, mind you, that was open all but 40% in last year's quarter. So, again, far overcoming the brick-and-mortar losses from last year's first quarter. And let's keep in mind, too, that they expected comps to come in around 0% for fiscal 2022. They said, well, we might lose low single digits, might gain low single digits, but it's going to be somewhere around 0%. After this amazing call, they increased their outlook to high single to low double digits for the year in terms of year-over-year sales as a result of these comp numbers. Now, what was interesting is the slowing of e-commerce growth only showed 1% growth year over year. And of course, customers in those 40% of days where Hibbett stores were closed during last year's first quarter, they had to go online, they had to go to e-commerce. So not a huge surprise that it didn't take a massive leap over last year. But leadership actually said that this was not only because of the additional store openings, but it was also because launch activity for in-demand products, so think footwear and sneakers here, for example, shifted back to in-store for some of their partners, like, for example, Nike or perhaps Under Armour, and that pushed traffic back to stores and away from e-commerce, which therefore parlayed itself into that triple-digit same-store sales increase year-over-year for brick-and-mortar activity and just that 1% increase year-over-year for e-commerce activity. Net sales, when you look at the chain overall, those increased in lockstep with comps up 87.8%. Mike Longo, their CEO, attributed this overall increase in revenue to several things. Stimulus funds, of course, hitting the pockets of consumers. Improved in-stocks as well, although that continues to be somewhat of a problem. We'll talk about that in a second. New customer acquisition, they saw a lot of new customers walking through those doors. And, of course, the easing out of the pandemic as those reasons for the overall increase. Better yet, Hibbett's gross margin improved by a whopping 1,390 basis points And again, the reasons were plenty here. We knew their gross margin was going to be challenged last year, closing those brick and mortar stores temporarily, but still paying rents on them while not getting any sales. That, of course, is going to hamper gross margins. But this year, higher sell-through, fewer promotions, as many retailers have noted. And actually, it was interesting this last week, speaking of the dollar store earnings, Dollar General actually noted more promotions in their sales activity. But for Hibbett, fewer promotions certainly helping out. And also for them, a shift away from e-commerce sales in the overall sales mix as a percentage of their overall sales helped out. For Hibbett, as with many smaller size retailers, and we talk about Hibbett being small, they still have over 1,000 locations, but e-commerce fulfillment carries a much higher cost than selling in stores. So the fact that more customers turning to in-store to buy those products, that's a positive for Hibbett as well. Additionally, they noted deleveraging of rent as a reason for their expansion of gross margin. Of course, rent mostly remained static for them, actually went down a little bit for them while these sales were exploding. In fact, their overall lease obligations are down significantly, about 12% from last year, although they did tick up slightly from Q4 of 2021. So you're looking sequentially quarter over quarter there. That represents not only store closures, but also their work with some landlords to move rents to a more favorable position, especially when leases are ending. And that's something with these type of sales numbers Hibbett may not be able to do much of after their last two quarters, as they are absolutely killing it on the brick and mortar front. Speaking of brick and mortar, one other thing to note, they appear to be back in growth mode in terms of their brick and mortar footprint after the elimination of some redundant stores following their City Gear acquisition, and also some closures of underperforming stores in very small southern markets. They showed positive net unit growth in the quarter. Specifically, they opened 6 stores this past quarter and closed just 2. Those 2 were not redundant stores. They fell into the underperforming category. And you look, that's of course a net opening of 4 new stores. They closed 5 net stores during the same quarter of last year, again when they were busy working City Gear into the fold. Now, perhaps the most important question and the question mark going forward for Hibbett is their inventory. It's difficult to compare year over year, of course, because of the sudden downturn in April of last year due to the pandemic, but their inventory was down 24.6% year over year, which of course will make those gross margin numbers look better, but it's not good because you're out of stock of a lot of items that customers want. And of course, demand ticking up in stores is one cause, but still inventories are down 20 million over the last 3 months alone. So sequentially, they're even down 20 million. And leadership said on the call itself that their inventories were around $80 to $100 million below where they wanted them to be based on their sales numbers. And the fact is that shortfall, leadership made no bones about this, that cost them sales in the first quarter. So as great as their first quarter numbers were, leadership said there was some money left on the table. And it's about supply chain constraints, honestly, here. They, again, talked about this repeatedly on the call. This, despite the fact that in-stocks have increased over the past several months, they said supply chain continues to be an issue for them, and they are working to kind of smooth it out. And one thing Leighton talked to me about as we were discussing this earnings call this weekend, just in our regular conversations, is that they're spending $45 to $50 million this fiscal year on capital improvements, including what they call back office improvements. But their acceleration of share repurchases that they're putting into place, that might be better used to bolster their inventory position. And they did say during the analyst Q&A that the leftover money after the share repurchases, after this CapEx, all of that is going to be used to bolster that inventory position. But you might think that maybe that would take more of a position in the forefront for leadership. At least that was Leighton's take. Indeed, one thing I noticed upon visits to Hibbett stores over the past couple of months and in speaking with the store managers, I was actually at a Hibbett store when they got a truck in. The only thing that went to the back stock room from that truck were shoes. Everything else that came in on that truck, sporting goods, clothing, whatever, that went directly out to the shelf. After the employees finished unloading the truck, boxes went straight out to the sales floor. All of that merchandise went straight onto the shelf. This particular Hibbett store knew that their sell-through was so strong that basically anything from the truck was not wasting any time in the back room at all. It was going straight out to the shelf. So very much an example of just-in-time inventory management, but that's not exactly, in this case, what Hibbett wants. They want some extra inventory in that back stock room because they know the sell-throughs are so strong. All that said, they're hoping to return to normal inventory levels by the back-to-school season. So some takeaways here, obviously, their inventory management and their inventory supply has to get better going forward. But positives, athleisure wear selling through quite a bit. Small and mid-sized markets seem to be strong in terms of consumer spending. In terms of discretionary spending, remember, a lot of what's sold at Hibbett is not exactly milk and eggs, of course. It is discretionary spend from these customers, and we see that in a very strong place in these small to mid-sized markets. But overall strength, apparel, footwear, sporting goods, something that we've seen throughout the rest of the industry. And even if you take a step back, look outside of the small and mid-sized markets, we are seeing now apparel sales tick up. We're seeing mall-based apparel retailers, in fact, have very good quarters, even better than pre-pandemic in certain circumstances, because people are going back to that. They're replenishing their wardrobe for the first time in a couple of years. So an interesting three quarters ahead for Hibbett. They don't expect crazy numbers like this to continue necessarily, as they continue to kind of put a buffer in there as far as their expectations for the next three quarters of this year. But this earnings call certainly suggests that a couple of different sectors are seeing retail success as we continue to turn through 2021. Well, after this break, we'll be joined by Roy Kleeper. Once again, he's the CEO and co-founder of City Hive. He'll be joining us to discuss the wine, spirits, and beer sales space, or retail space. And more specifically, we'll be talking about integration of e-commerce platforms by not only mom-and-pop retailers, but also small and large liquor store chains, and some of the hidden costs that might exist with using third-party services for last-mile fulfillment. Something we've addressed previously on the show is how the pandemic generally affected small retailers, particularly in the spirits space. Today, we're going to discuss order fulfillment by smaller retailers and the tie-ins to digital that independent spirits retailers can leverage. And while the likes of Drizzly, let's say, have gotten a lot of press lately, we'll discuss also some of the hidden costs of using those platforms for a retailer. Now, to discuss these things, we're joined by Roy Kleeper, CEO of City Hive. Roy, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Trent.
First, could you explain a little bit to our listeners about what City Hive is, what it does, and what you guys do on the day-to-day?
City Hive is a digital transformation platform for the wine and spirits retail industry. What we basically do is we power the digital infrastructure for wine and spirits independent liquors, single location, multi-location chains, franchise, some of the biggest retailers in the industry, as well as single location independents. What we do is we step into the store, connect to the existing infrastructure. We today integrate to basically every POS system out there, take the information and help the stores operate online through a website, through an app, through a loyalty plan, through a wine club, through an event management platform, through an advanced engagement platform, while introducing a lot of capabilities of automation and basically allow the stores that we work with to compete, to participate in the market first, and then to compete very efficiently with other stores, as well as compete and beat the offering that marketplaces that have spurred in the market have to offer to consumers.
Now, of course, you were a co-founder of the company back in 2016, and I'm curious, as we look back over the last 5 years, what was the landscape like in terms of digital sales, in terms of e-commerce for smaller independent liquor retailers then as compared to now?
So first of all, then as well as now, most of the retail stores in the wine and spirits industry had no or very limited digital presence or online presence. The ones that did have may have been doing very well because there were very few in the market, but most of the stores had at best a website. In many of the cases, it wasn't an e-com website, it was more informational, and they were not really participating in the online e-com ecosystem. Those that were participating typically were building the website in-house or by using an agency. That used to be very expensive. And the typical case would have been you spend a lot of money, it's operational for a while, and then it slowly or more rapidly deteriorates to the point that it's non-operational, then you need to invest again. What we basically introduced to the market is more of the SaaS model, where there is no upfront cost or hardly any upfront cost, zero risk to step into the market and participate. And then you pay a monthly fee, and that monthly fee is typically low, but it keeps with you and keeps the product current and at the cutting edge of technology. And the result of that was basically the dissolution of the relatively large number of agencies that were serving that industry. And today there's basically a one out of three websites that is coming up in the industry is powered by CD Hive, and that number is growing. The level of customization that CD Hive offers is huge. You could do basically anything you could imagine on the app, on the website, visually and logically. And so we serve anyone from a single location selling only wine and spirits in New York to major chains selling across tens and sometimes more than 100 locations, selling wine and spirits, deli, specialty food, sometimes coffee, again, as the regulatory environment allows them.
And you mentioned the regulatory environment. That kind of leads into my next question, because obviously the pandemic accelerated maybe progress, you would say, on the regulatory environment in certain states, especially in the U.S. But what are some of the considerations that have to go into developing e-commerce sites for these independent retailers, knowing that U.S. states have vastly different alcohol regulations, not only whether or not things can be sold online, but what can be sold online as well?
Yeah, so first of all, there's the very basic things. When you build a website and you're selling alcohol, you need to sell to people that are above 21. And that's something that, you know, may put you in a little bit of a weird place because there's no presence of a person in front of you. So how do you verify the age? And so that's one challenge. And the answer to that is fairly simple. At the end of this transaction, there will be a meeting where you'll exchange the goods. You'll give them the wine or the spirits or the beer. So the verification of age needs to be done. And there are tools that are introduced digitally to make sure that you're actually doing it appropriately and keeping record of that. So that's kind of like a very basic thing. Another very basic thing that, again, not specific to the wine and spirits industry, but is kind of touches on regulation a little bit, is you're building a website, you're selling online, you need to be accessible. So ADA compliance is something that needs to be thought of. And that's kind of putting you in a situation where if you're not compliant, you're opening yourself up for potential lawsuits by whoever makes those lawsuits happen. So that's something that you need to keep in mind, particularly for the wine and spirits industry. There's obviously the three-tier distribution model. So what you can do, what you can't do in that sense. How can you work efficiently with distributors? How can you work efficiently with suppliers? Independent wine and spirits stores are responsible for, in the off-premise space, for a very high percentage of the GMV, the gross sales in that particular industry. But from a budget, from a marketing budget perspective, of the manufacturers, the producers, the distributors, they're not enjoying even a fraction of that. And that's kind of, there's a question why. And that's because regulation kind of is in the way of them being able to use those budgets. So budgets are either spent by the producers and manufacturers extremely inefficiently, or they find ways through other means to spend that money, which may be competing with you as a store. One of the missions of CDI is to figure out ways in which collaboration between you as an independent and your distributors, as well as your manufacturers, could happen within the three-tier distribution system. A third point that is touches on regulatory environment is, can you even sell online? And if you can't sell online, what's the point of having a website? And there is a point of having a website, regardless if you can sell online or you can't. there's a lot of value to having a website in driving traffic in store, doing event, education, classes, nurturing a relationship with your customers. CityHive is a very, very advanced engagement platform that is cross-channel, could engage with your customers over push notification, over email, over text, invite them in, give them points, award them with rewards, have them participate in raffles, create communities, small groups, all that other stuff. There's a lot of value there. Getting back to regulation, let's say you can sell online. How can you sell online? Is pickup allowed? Is curbside pickup allowed? Is delivery allowed? What are the restrictions of delivery? Do you need to deliver it organically, meaning with your own driver, like it is the case in Colorado, for example, your home state, or in New Jersey? And if not, if you could use third parties, how do you use third parties efficiently? Because the cost, then again, you're kind of like moving away from regulatory environment with, let's say it's allowed, regulatory environment allows you, how do you do it efficiently? Because if you're not doing it efficiently, you'll be selling volume, but you'll be losing money, or you'll not be making money, which kind of beats the point. So CityHive brings the techniques, the tools, the optimizations to make sure, one, that you're selling the right things, things that you're making money on, which, again, if you're thinking about marketplaces, marketplaces sell the national items, the ones that you're typically making less of a margin on. So while you're moving volume, you may not be making money. So CityHive helps retailers really push the items that they want to push. And that's kind of a little bit of what we're doing and how we're handling different aspects of regulatory environment. And I even did not touch on shipping, which is a completely different and big story, constantly changing.
Yeah, it seems like it. Well, especially the regulatory atmosphere surrounding shipping also not only constantly changing over the last 6 months to a year, but probably changing pretty rapidly over the next couple of years as well. I want to take a step back, though. Let's say a business comes to you. They want to use the CityHive platform. Just to kind of illustrate it for our listeners, what are some of the processes that you go through in order to get an independent spirits retailer up to speed with their e-commerce presence?
So one thing about CityHive is that is very important for people to know, we're fast. We're extremely fast. We're the fastest in the market, and in two different ways. First of all, our platform is fast, faster than household names like Shopify, WordPress, Squarespace, Wix. If you look at the websites that we build and measure them in performance using common tools like Google Performance Measurement, CityHive will beat them, and will beat them by a margin. So that's one thing. The other thing is we're fast in terms of go-to-market. If you want to go live, if you really want to go live and you invite us in, we'll be live within less than 10 minutes after saying hello, and that will include your entire inventory and your customer data. The way that's happening is we're coming into the store, not physically, virtually, through a share screen. We connect to your inventory, POS system, whatever POS system you have, we're good. 98% of the existing markets already covered by us. So POS is like anything in the cloud, as well as anything that is 40 year old. We can connect to it, pull the inventory, digest it quickly, put it online, and the website is live. Now all you need to do is connect your domain to it. If you have a domain, assuming you have a domain, if you don't, you buy a domain, connect the domain, you're live, you can process transaction. That's it. That's where it starts. That's not a typical case. Typically, a store would not go live within 10 minutes because, you know, the operator needs some education, the owner needs some approval, they need to see what's going on. But that's kind of like just to describe what's in the realm of possibility. The typical case is that you'll go live within 1-2 days, and then the work starts because you're basically getting a templated website at this point, but you have a lot of customization capabilities to customize the categories, the look and feel, the images, the structure of the website, the logic of the website. Are you selling only 750, or do you want to sell 375? Do you don't want to do bundles? Do you want to offer clubs? Do you want to offer free shipping? Do you want to do coupons, first-time coupons? Do you want to set up abandoned cart capabilities? Do you want to offer case discounts? All those things are things that kind of you can configure in the system. Our marketing team, our operation team, our customer success team will help you with that. We're available either through a ticketing system or to schedule a call any number of times that you could schedule a call with us. We're good on that. We'll show up. We'll guide you through. The big thing, though, is that once you set things up, then you get to be really sophisticated and you want to set some automations. Automations are things like when someone has a birthday, send them this wish over text message. When someone hasn't shown up for 30 days, send them this coupon. When a big order comes in, please alert my manager. All those things are really small automations that really make your store efficient and competing at the highest level. And what's interesting about this is, you know, it used to be thought of as the online game as either go big or go home. But the fact of the matter is that independent wine and spirit stores, pure wine and spirit stores, if they manage to nurture a good group of 1,000 customers, they have $1 million annual business online alone. And if you understand that and think about it clearly, there are 365 days a year, you need to acquire 3 a day. Can your floor manager acquire 3 good customers a day? And the answer is clearly yes. And that builds equity in your business. Contrary to what you get from other places, which is orders, you get customers. Orders are cash flow. And they're good. I'm not against cash flow. Cash flow is important. Customers are equity. Customers are retail value. When you come to look at your business, where is your assets? It's the inventory, for one, and it's the customer base.
So I wanted to kind of wrap up with this. And kind of as I mentioned in the open, there are some hidden costs potentially, not just tangible costs, but also sometimes intangible costs using platforms like Drizly, like Seamless. What are some of the dynamics around retailers using maybe services like that versus having their own bespoke e-commerce website?
The two important terms that everyone that's doing a online sales, but everyone that's actually doing commerce, not e-commerce, commerce, is very much aware of is what's the cost of customer acquisition? How much does it cost me to bring a customer in to make them from a pass by to a customer acquisition? The other one is customer retention. I have a customer, what does it cost me to keep them? And in that sense, those marketplaces that you've mentioned, working with them is inviting the fox into the hen house. You're basically giving them access to the customer. And at first it looks very appealing because, you know, they do the job, they do the marketing for you, but are they doing the marketing for you or are they doing the marketing for them? They don't give you the customer information or the full customer information. You can't engage with the customer. They could keep the customer elsewhere at any given point in time, and they do. And so what happens is that you're gaining cash flow but diluting your equity value. And the sad part here is that getting the customers back is very possible, but it's getting harder the more you wait. We've done, you know, some drastic steps in certain markets and have taken back the market to be owned by the independents. But why lose them at the first place? Why not owning your customers? Why not nurturing that relationship and really providing them with the kind of service and value that you can? The fortunate point here is that independent retailers have a lot more to offer than what the marketplace have, because they have the in-store, they have the face-to-face, they could do tasting, they could do invitations, they could give a smile. Everything that they know how to do for the last 20, 30 years, they just need to figure out how to translate and use the digital tool as a part of their toolbox in their daily procedures. And so that's what City Hive allows them to do, and that's how they become successful. That's how we've reached from 2016 to 2020, from 10 stores in New York to over 2,000 stores, 38 states, 700 cities, and doing about $500 million in sales across our network. And we're not doing the sales, we don't own the customer. The stores own the customer. The stores own the transaction. The stores are making money. And just to kind of wrap up with maybe last point, they choose what to sell. So it means that a sale on City Hive has a completely different and much favorable profit margin. So while you could sell elsewhere, you sell the right things here and you're making money, you're bringing more money home, you're a healthier business. That's what we offer.
Some interesting insights there, especially regarding being able to have the leverage to sell products or at least put products to the forefront that feature a higher margin. Well, once again, Roy, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Trent. It's been a pleasure.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Roy once again for joining us here, and it's time to look ahead at a story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year, and in this case, very much for the next week or month. I mentioned the dollar stores, of course, had earnings this week. Both dollar store chains noted freight costs and shipping costs as having gone up. And in fact, Dollar Tree mentioned freight costs might hinder them by as much as 80 cents per share on a per share basis for the rest of this year as compared with 2020. Dollar General also said a similar thing, although didn't put necessarily a price on it. Both companies, of course, mentioned increasing labor costs and just a difficulty in terms of finding labor specifically for distribution centers. That's something that we've addressed on the podcast before. So I'm really looking ahead at shipping costs and freight costs. Not only are you seeing fuel prices rise, but of course, labor is not as cheap as it was a year or two ago. Labor is more difficult to find. So that's going to increase costs in every step of the supply chain. So for businesses that experience high turnover, particularly in several groups of products, so you're looking at general merchandise retailers like the dollar stores, you're looking at grocers as well, how exactly will freight impact the bottom line? And honestly, Dollar General certainly, and to an extent Dollar Tree, they're as much of a grocery retailer in certain markets as anywhere else. Talked about grocery inflation as well. That's just another facet that they'll have to worry about in terms of making sure their margins are where they want them to be. Now, all of that being said, Dollar General did increase its forecast for fiscal 2021 as far as the bottom line is concerned. So again, they seem to be chugging along just fine. But there are other companies that maybe don't operate on as high a margins as what you have at Dollar General and Dollar Tree, looking certainly at grocers. So how will the freight costs impact everyone throughout the retail industry, especially those that have that high turnover, that have, unlike Hibbett, where Hibbett stores might get one truck per week, they might get a truck every couple of weeks. There are retailers out there, certainly, that are getting multiple trucks per day. Multiple trucks per day means, of course, fuel costs for each of those trucks. It means labor costs for each of those trucks. So, again, certain dynamics playing out that make you think that either the cost is going to have to be passed along to the consumer at some point, or these retailers are going to take a hit on margin. And if you had to guess which of these impacts would happen, I would probably take the former rather than the latter. It's not very often that retailers choose to take a hit on margin if they can pass along the cost to the consumer. So it will be an interesting backdrop, an interesting landscape, if you will, for retailers during the next 6 months is navigating fuel price increases, navigating freight price increases, navigating third-party freight price increases, something we saw in the back portion of 2020 as well. So that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast this week. I hope everyone had a pleasant Memorial Day weekend, long weekend for many of us, not, of course, those of us in retail, but many of us here in the United States, and we'll be back with you about 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.